like to discuss something that I have, and I do. Usually my rule is I don't do lessons more than, if I want to repeat a lesson, I try to wait about 10 years before I repeat something, because that way I know most people don't remember. I tried 5 years and Dave remembered every once in a while. So I moved it up to 10. But this particular lesson, there were some things I wanted to add to it, some things I wanted to change. And so I wanted to make a few updates to it. I did this not all that long ago. I think it was about 3 years ago that I last did this. But I wanted to go through and talk about the idea about drinking. There are a lot of different ideas in the New Testament or in among Christians about whether Christians ought to drink or not. A lot of the difficulties come not because the scriptures aren't plain or clear, but where a lot of the difficulties come in the actual translations. For instance, most people understand quite clearly that the scriptures teach that drinking or drunkenness, I should say, that drunkenness is condemned in the scriptures. Take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and starting with verse 9. Or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. Very clearly, drunkards cannot inherit the kingdom of God. You cannot be a Christian and be a drunkard at the same time. It just doesn't fit. In Romans chapter 13 and in verse 13, Romans 13, verse 13, it says, let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy. Again, we're not to behave as drunks. Drunkenness and carousing are improper behaviors for a Christian. And very few people will argue that a down-and-out drunk is acceptable. We understand it as wrong. So where does the problem come in? Well, the problem really comes in is how drunk is drunk. We want to have a little bit of drinking without stepping over the line of sin. And the problem is we don't know where the line is. Now, a person who has been drinking really heavily will argue with you that they're not drunk. Does that make them any less drunk? There are states that set levels of drunkenness where it's unacceptable to drive. Does that become then the standard? Some people believe that a few drinks once in a while is all right. Some people believe a drink with dinner is acceptable. And some people believe that all alcohol ought to be avoided. And then here becomes the difficulty. We understand the one end of the spectrum is wrong, even though we don't know exactly where we're going to put the line at for that spectrum. But where can we put the line? And part of the problem that we have is in the translations of our Bible. Most of the translations take all the words that have to do with beverages and translate them as wine, regardless of how it's used. And in our modern terminology, we use wine as to refer to an alcoholic drink. And so people make conclusions not based on what the scriptures actually say, but based on what a translation says it says. And we have to look and be careful about it. And we have to understand, what is it about alcohol that causes so much problems? Why is it a difficulty? In Proverbs chapter 20, in verse 1, Proverbs 20 and in verse 1, wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. alcohol is a product that's deceptive. There's a reason for it. It's a depressive. It slows down the reaction time of the body and the mind. It numbs the responses. That's why states have limits on how much you can drink. That's why you can't drive well with while you're drinking. The person who is drunk, or at least gone above the legal limits, thinks he can drive perfectly well. And I've had arguments with people who I know could barely walk and yet ask for the car keys. Because, yes, I used to work in a company and we went out to dinner and I could see that. And they knew I wasn't about to give them. In fact, I took the car keys before they even had dinner. And I said, I'm the designated driver. But is it depressive? Because it's depressive, you don't know what's going on. Not accurately. People who drink have no idea how drunk they are because the drink is affecting their judgment. They'll tell you they know when their limit is. But it's not really true. It's deceptive also because it's progressive. One drink doesn't totally wipe you out. Even two drinks may not totally wipe you out. Drunkenness is a degree of drunkenness. And there is where some of the deception comes in, because people argue about where the line is, and it moves while they're under the influence. Also, we find in Isaiah chapter 28, Isaiah chapter 28, and in verse 7, Isaiah 28, and in verse 7, those who also reel with wine and stagger from strong drink, the priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. They are confused by wine. They stagger from strong drink. They reel having visions. They totter when rendering judgments. And we're going to come back to this idea of reeling and tottering and why that happens. But I want you to know one thing. It says they are confused by wine. It causes errors in judgment. A person under the effect of alcohol doesn't think clearly. It's just a matter of fact. They make decisions they would never make when they're sober. You want proof of that? What happens in parties when people start getting drunk? They start acting odd. Acting like they normally don't do. They put lampshades on their heads. Common joke. Now, most people don't walk around that way. But they do it while drunk. Why? Because it changes the judgments that they make. In fact, it also causes errors in moral judgments. Take a look at Habakkuk chapter 2. Habakkuk chapter 2. And in verse 15. Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk, so as to look on their nakedness. People do things while drunk they would never do while sober. For example, Noah became the brunt of his son's ridicule. In Genesis chapter 9, Genesis chapter 9 and in verse 20, so then Noah began farming and planting a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were turned away so they did not see their father's nakedness. Now at least Noah stayed inside his tent. But it was something of a shame, a way he behaved. Ham tried to make a joke out of it. His brothers wouldn't go along with it. They refused even to look because Ham made a spectacle of it. But we understand the reason why this occurred was because Noah was drinking. In fact, alcohol is often used as a way to escape depression. If you ask somebody who drinks and has drunk for a long time, why do you drink? And they'll start telling you about all the woes and the problems, and it's just a way of coping with life. And yet I find that interesting, because it does in effect make a person feel like they're coping with some problem. It's a depressive. It makes problems seem not so severe while you're under it. But at the same time, it is causing depression. It makes life feel more like there's problems. Take a look at Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs 23, starting with verse 29. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine, those who go to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things. Your mind will utter perverse things. And you'll be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea, or like one who lies down on the top of a mast. They struck me, but I did not become ill. They beat me, but I did not know it. When shall I awake? I will seek another drink. I want you to notice some things that it mentions here. It causes woes. It causes sorrows. It causes strife and anger. It causes babbling or loosening of tongues. It affects memory. That's why there's wounds without cause, because people don't remember when they got hit and hurt themselves. And verse 32 makes the point, it is poisonous. It bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. A serpent's bite, a rattlesnake's bite, affects the circulation in a person. An adder's bite affects the nervous system. Both of them can kill you. And it's saying alcohol does both. I had an article in my files for years. I don't know who wrote it. But the title of it is, What is Wrong with a Friendly Glass of Beer? I was speaking to a teenager at a high school conference, and one fellow came up to me and said, Now, Doc, I don't drink. I don't intend to drink. But actually, what is wrong with a friendly glass of beer? I said, Do you know anything about chemistry of alcohol? No, he said, I don't. I said, Alcohol is one of the greatest blessings God ever gave us. It is? I thought it was just a curse, he said. No, it's a great blessing. The two reagents on a chemist reagents rack, which he uses as solvents, are alcohol and water. Alcohol dehydrates and it dissolves. It's a marvelous thing. The photographic industry, tinctures, dyes, medicines, all kinds of things make use of alcohol. There are 19 kinds of commercial alcohol, which brilliant chemists have developed, and we produce them by the tons. The kind of alcohol you drink is one type, ethyl. The kind you put in your radiator is another kind, methyl. But all alcohols are poisonous. In the body, they're going to cause ill effects. The reason is that they dehydrate and they dissolve. If you got a little imagination, let's do a little chemical experiment here in your imagination. Let us take 16 bottles. In the first 8, we'll put alcohol, and in the last 8, we'll put water. Over here, we will see that the alcohol dissolves, and here it hardens. Take, for example, some kind of fat and put it on water. It will just float around. What if we put fat in alcohol, shake it up, and it will dissolve? Take some resin, put it in alcohol, shake it up, it will dissolve. It goes to the bottom of water and stays there. What happens to camphor? It floats on the water. Put it in alcohol, it will dissolve. We have fat, resin, and camphor. They dissolve in alcohol. Put a green leaf in alcohol, and it will take the color out. Put these things in water, and nothing happens. Now shift over here. Put a little bit of bread in alcohol. What happens? It will get hard. Put a piece of meat in alcohol. What will happen? It gets hard. It dehydrates. It takes the water out of the meat. Now this dehydrating and dissolving are the characteristics of alcohol, which makes it a great blessing. But friends, when it goes down into your gullet, it does not know if it's inside or outside. As soon as it gets in there, it begins to work in the same way. Is not affected by gastric juices, is absorbed through the walls of the stomach into the bloodstream, and all your nerves and your brains are bathed with it. Every nerve has fatty substance, which are called lipids, and the moment alcohol touches it, what happens? Alcohol dissolves it. When you dissolve the covering and the insulation of the nerves, it's just like a telephone exchange in which the insulation is off. You do not get the message through the proper source. This is why men stagger. They call for their right leg to act, and the left leg gets the message. When alcohol goes into the heart of the nerves, that happens to be like the white of an egg. Alcohol cooks it. Alcohol is a great harm to the human body and mind because of these two properties of dissolving and dehydrating. Furthermore, alcohol is a narcotic, a deterrent of normal body functions. It is a poison that adversely affects our judgment and self-control. It is, we believe, the harm of our offspring because it poisons the life-giving cells. We talked for a half hour, and finally the teenager said, "Sir, for the first time I've ever seen an intelligent answer as to why I should not drink beer. Thank God you told us." Now, if that's, people understand there's problems with drinking alcohol, then why do we find people in the Bible talking, it says that they drink wine? See, all people drink. I drank today. I had enough, so I was drunk. But not drunk in the sense of alcoholic drunk. See, there's a way we use the words. You have to be careful about it. All people drink, but it makes a difference as to what they drink. And the greatest difficulty is getting a definition that is not biased by the person's desire to justify what they want to do. So rather than going to various dictionaries and various encyclopedias or things like that, what I like to propose that we do is look at how the words are used in the scriptures so that you understand where it's coming from. Yes, I know. You can. I've had people argue this. Well, you know, Thayer says, yes, I know, Thayer says that. But I want you to look and see how it's used in the Bible. And see what that definition would be better. The first word we're going to look at, and we're going to define the words by their use. The first word we're going to look at is yayin. That is, and I'll just tell you up front, that is a generic word that is used to define all juice that's made from grapes. Whether we're talking about fresh grape juice, fermented grape juice, or anything in between. It's used 144 times in the Old Testament. To show this, let's go to Nehemiah chapter 5. Nehemiah chapter 5 and in verse 18. Nehemiah chapter 5 and in verse 18. Now there was prepared for each day was one ox, six choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me. Once in 10 days, all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. Yet for all this, I did not demand the governor's food allowance, because the servitude was heavy on this people. The word yayin is used, the word wine there. And notice it says there's all sorts. There's not just one thing, one type of beverage, that's yayin. There's a lot of different things that can all be classified as yayin. And that's the point that we want to make from this particular verse. Now, yayin is used of juice that's still in the grapes. I don't think you can get much fresher than that. It hasn't even come out of the skin yet. Take a look at Isaiah 16. Isaiah 16, and in verse 10. Gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field. In the vineyards also there will be no cries of jubilant or shouting, no treaders out of wine in the presses. For I made the shouting to cease. You don't get wine by stepping on fresh grapes. You get juice, but you don't get wine. But the word wine is used here, but it's the word yayin. In Deuteronomy 28 and verse 39. Deuteronomy 28 and in verse 39. You shall plant and cultivate vineyards, but you'll neither drink of wine nor gather the grapes, for the worms will devour them. They have vineyards being planted, and they said, you're not going to drink from what you got gathered from the vineyards. And his word again is yayin. Maybe not quite as clear, but it says you can't drink the juice because the worms will eat the grapes. That's in here. Now, it's also used of fresh grape juice in Jeremiah 48. Jeremiah 48 and verse 33. So gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field, from the land of Moab. I have made the wine to cease from the wine presses. No one will tread them with shouting. The shouting will not be the shouts of joy. Again, the point is that you get juice from a grape, a press. It has not had chance to ferment yet. Yet it's talking about it. The juice would cease to flow from the presses. Again, it's the word yayin. Now, yayin is also used of a product, and we're going to talk more about this later. I don't think I'll be getting to it by tonight. But in Proverbs chapter 9, it mentions something that I've seen a lot of commentators even misapply and misunderstand this particular verse. Proverbs 9, verse 2, she has mixed or prepared her food, she has mixed her wine, she has also set her table. What it's referring to is that one form of yayin, or one form of product that they had, was where they boiled down the juice to a thick syrup. And then they reconstituted it by mixing water back in. The reason for that is that when you boil it down, the sugar levels rise and it doesn't ferment. There's too much sugar there for the yeast to live. It's the same reason why you can keep honey out. It's too sweet for to ferment. And so they did that with their juice. They boiled it down. And then to drink it, grape syrup is a little bit too much. So you have to mix the water back in to drink it down. In verse 5, it says, come eat of my food and the drink of the wine that I have mixed. Yayin is also used, as we saw in Proverbs 20 and verse 1 that we read earlier. It's in that list. It's used of fermented juice. It's saying it's deceptive. It's obviously talking about something that has alcohol in it. So yayin is also used for that. But also I want you to take note in Proverbs 23 and verse 30, we had read that verse also. But I want you to take note of something that's easy to skip over. In verse 30 of Proverbs 23, it says, those who linger over wine, those who go to taste mixed wine. Okay. Wine and mixed wine, and mixed wine is actually one word in the Hebrew. But they're used interchangeably. And what they're referring to in this case is not mixed with water, but mixed with herbs. Or possibly mixed with extra sugar. Adding more sweetening to it. If you add more sugars to a drink, you can increase the alcoholic content. Or what they would do is sometimes mix herbs in it that had hallucinogenic effects, because alcohol will extract those chemicals from the herbs. Another verse that uses the same thing is Isaiah 5 and verse 22. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine, that's yayin, and valiant men in mixing strong drink. And again, it's talking about a mixed wine, something where other products are added to it to boost its effect. So, in other words, even though our translations generally use wine in all those cases, it doesn't indicate by itself whether it's intoxicating or not. You can't just by reading the word yayin and come to the conclusion just because yayin's there that automatically we're talking about an intoxicating drink. Sometimes it's very clear from the context. Sometimes it's very clear it's not from the context. And sometimes you don't know from the context. But you can't make a conclusion. We need to understand that. There's another word that we want to look at, and it's tirash. Tirash is the word for new wine. It's usually the way it's translated. But notice, how do you have new wine? When wine has to sit there and ferment, but we use it today. New wine actually refers to fresh grape juice, something that's not fermented. In Isaiah 65, Tirash in Isaiah 65 and verse 8. Thus says the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one says, do not destroy it, for there is benefit in it. So I'll act on behalf of my servants in order not to destroy all of them. The word tirash is there where it says new wine. As the tirash is found in the cluster. Haven't even broke the skin of the grapes. Tirash is what's inside a grape. In Proverbs 3 in verse 10. Proverbs 3 and verse 10. So your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. Tirash. So squeeze grape juice in the vats is tirash. That's why they put the word new in front of it. They're actually trying to say this is grape juice. Not fermented, but grape juice. Another word is Mishra, and we can find this in Numbers 6 and verse 3. This is one that's not usually debated too much. Mishra in Numbers chapter 6. It's not used very often in the Old Testament. In fact, I think this may be the only place it's used. Talking about the Nazirite vow. He shall abstain from wine and strong drink, shall drink no vinegar, neither made from wine or strong drink, nor shall he drink any grape juice, there's the word Mishra, or eat fresh or dry grapes. Mishra just means juice, is what it means. That's the word that's there. Shimer is a actually it means the blood of the grapes. Especially if you take red grapes and you squeeze them, they come out that purplish color. It kind of looks bloody. That's where chimer emphasizes. It's the fresh foaming from the vat red juice. Take a look at Deuteronomy 32. Deuteronomy 32. And in verse 14. curds of cows and milk of the flock, with fat of rams, lambs and rams, the breed of Bashan and goats, the finest of wheat, and the blood of grapes. That's Chirmer. You may drink, you drink wine. So here Yayin's referring to Chirmer, which is the blood of grapes, the red stuff that comes out of the grapes. Dima first. Dima actually means tears, like you're crying, which kind of describes what happens when you squeeze a grape. It looks like it cries. So Exodus chapter 22. Exodus 22 and verse 29. You shall not delay the offering from your harvest and your vintage. The firstborn of your sons you shall give. Oops. Write down the. You shall not delay the offering of your harvest and your vintage. And that's the word there. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Vintage there is the word dima. It literally means tears. And again, it refers to the juice of a grape. Asis, which is the next word, is a little broader. It's juice, but it doesn't, is not limited to grape juice. It's any type of fruit. In Song of Solomon, chapter 8. Song of Solomon, chapter 8. And in verse 2, it says, I would lead you and bring you to the house of your mother who instructed me. I'll give you spiced wine to drink from the juice of my pomegranates. So it's talking about here pomegranate juice that's made into a spiced drink. In Amos chapter 9. Amos chapter 9. And in verse 13. Amos chapter 9, verse 13. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, the treader of grapes, him who sows seeds, when the mountains will drip sweet wine, and all the hills will be dissolved. And that word there is again, asis, where it says sweet wine, or new wine, depending on your translation. It's again referring to fresh juice of any type of fruit. Now going back to that thickened grape juice, that word, the specific word for it is sobe. And you can see it in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 22, where they boiled it down. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 22. And then had to reconstitute it. It says, your silver has become dross and your drink diluted with water. And the word there is sobe. In this case, it's talking about putting too much water into the reconstitution, so it's watered down. The last, we've got two more words. Next word, the main one we want to look at is shikar. Usually that's translated as strong drink. Any fermented drink, it can be made from barley, it can be made from dates, it can be made from fruits, grains. In other words, a natural beer would be called shikar in Hebrew. Shikar is almost always condemned. There's two verses there, exceptions. We'll talk about that. But shikar is almost always condemned. Again, in Proverbs 20, verse 1, which we read earlier, it talks about strong drink is raging. That's the word shikar. In Leviticus chapter 10 and in verse 9, Leviticus chapter 10, and in verse 9, do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you will not die. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations. Priests were not allowed to drink strong drink and serve in the temple. Absolutely forbidden. Could not do that. Or other forms of wine either. And since it's connected with shikar, it probably was talking about the alcoholic form. Also in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 11. Isaiah chapter 5 verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that the wine may inflame them. As talking to princes, those who rule. And God declares a woe to them when they're drinking. And the reason for that is simple. They're not allowed to drink. They're supposed to be making judgments. We do the same thing today. We don't want workers on the job drinking. You don't want even the Cox cable man coming by and he's drunk, try to do your wiring. It's probably going to have to be redone 4 or 5 times before it gets done. We don't want people making judgments in places of power who are using alcohol. And so shikar was forbidden to them. There's only two places where I can find an indication that shikar is used in an approved manner. And one of them is in Numbers 28 and in verse 7. And yes, I have gone through every single passage that has shikar in it, looking for these things. Numbers 28, verse 7. Not that I couldn't have missed one. You know, after a while, you read 50 verses in a row and it starts to blend. But I only found two. Numbers 28, verse 7. Then this drink offering with it shall be a fourth of a hin for each lamb. In the holy place you shall pour out a drink offering of strong drink to the Lord. So when they did the drink offering, they used strong drink. They used shikar on that offering. Now, that's used on the offering. They didn't say they drank it. Okay, but there is shikar that's used, and it's used in an approved purpose. In Deuteronomy 14, Deuteronomy 14 and verse 26, you may spend your money on whatever your heart desires. It's talking about for sacrifices. For oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink or whatever your heart desires. And there you shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice you and your household. Now here is probably the closest one. When they brought in their tithe, they were to bring in and they could buy, if they traveled from a long distance, they could either bring what they had, or if they traveled from a long distance, they were allowed to buy whatever that was they wanted to buy as part of their tithe offering. Now, in that offering, it was to be shared with the Levites. Take a look at starting with verse 27. Deuteronomy 14, verse 27. You shall not neglect the Levites who is in your town, for he is no portion or inheritance among you. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce in that year and shall deposit in your town. The Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien and the orphans and the widows who are in your town shall come and eat and be satisfied, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the works that you do, which you do in your hand. Now, one of the things I want you to notice is this is being shared. This is a shared meal. And what composed of it, they have choices of. People are assuming, they see the word shikar there, and they say, oh, they were drinking it. Possibly. There are other ways that it can be used too. People still use cooking wine. People use liquids as flambés. I don't know. It was part of this as part of their tithe offering. When it talks about the drink offering, it could have been, as far as I know, they poured it on the drink offering before they lit it. Sounds like a starter fluid to me. At least on the ones in Numbers. But here it could be possible that it may have been drunk. But even if alcohol was allowed to be consumed, it's once a year here. And then it would have to be condemned the rest of the year because all the other verses have said it was condemned. The other problem is this is Old Testament and it doesn't really prove that we can drink it today. We have to go to New Testament for that. But I want you to also know, since it's shared with the Levites and the priests are from the Levites, the priests couldn't take the shikar. Not in serving the temple at the same time. So we have one verse saying you could do it and another verse saying you can't do it. At least on one day of each year. Another thing, though, we want to look at is it should be noted that the natural fermentation of any drink doesn't produce anything of greater than 14% alcohol. You have to do extra stuff to get the alcohol content higher. You have to distill it to get it higher than that. But what we call beer, that was shikar under the Old Testament. The regular wines, the natural wines, they were called shikar. They're strong drinks. We're not talking about the fortified stuff that's on the supermarket shelves. And we're definitely not talking about the Jack Daniels whiskey. We're not even close to that level. But it was condemned. Except for in this one case, there may be a possibility, depending on how it was used, that might be they drank it. But for me, there's too many ifs involved in that to say, this is proof. No, it's not proof. It's not solid enough. Another verse is in Mishka. And this is wine that's mixed with herbs or with honey. It refers to adding sugars to increase the alcoholic content or herbs to increase the intoxicating effects. They knew that if you took grapes and the grape that year wasn't that sweet, that they can add an extra honey to it and get it the alcohol content up. And they knew that certain herbs, when you mix it with alcohol, had an extra effect. And so you have the mixed wine that we already noted in Proverbs 23:30. And it was also mentioned as an offering to idols in Isaiah 65, verse 11. Sorry, there's only two verses that's used in. Isaiah 65, verse 11. But you go for sake the Lord, who forget my holy mountain, who set a table for fortune, who will fill cups with mixed wine for destiny. And it's talking about enhanced wine of some sort. Other things mixed with it to make it more toxic or alcoholic or whatever the effect is. Now, later on we're going to talk about, we're not going to do it today. We had one word that covered all grape products. That's yain in the Hebrew. In Greek, that same word is onus. Oinus is the same type of thing. It's a general, generic word that talks about all grape products. When the Septuagint was done, the Old Testament, which was translated into Greek, every time yain was used, they used oinus to translate that same word. I'm looking at my time. I'm looking how much I got to cover. I think I can do it. I'll go over just a little bit. Now, for years, people argued that the ancients did not have a method for preserving grape juice. So it's bound to become alcoholic. If you ever tried keeping grape juice without a refrigerator, it doesn't last. It starts going sour really quick. And actually, without a controlled environment, spoiled grape juice is more likely to turn vinegar than wine. I've had somebody who's a better microbiologist argue about that. But everything I read says grape juice will spoil, and if you want wine, you got to treat it right. And so, yes, it may be a more complex chain of reactions, but it's easier to get vinegar. There are three methods that we know the ancients had for preserving grape juice. We already mentioned the boiling of the juice. in Hermann Bohr's Elements of Chemistry on page 81. It says, by boiling the juice of the richest grapes loses all its aptitude for fermentation and may afterwards be preserved for years without undergoing any further changes. You can boil grape juice down thick enough that it's so sweet that it won't alter, just like honey. Did they know back then? Yes. In the first century, Camilla said it is common in Italy and Greece to boil wine. That was a first century statement. They knew about boiling wine. Pliny, from 62 to 113 AD, wrote that after two centuries of production, Opian wine had the consistency of honey. So if we have any doubts, they talk about the boiled wine is thick like honey. Virgil, who lived from 70 to 19 BC, said to make wine keep, they boil the juice down to one half or to one third of its original volume. This is before Christ. They knew about it. In fact, the reason the Jewish Mishnah teaches Jews to water down their wine was because they commonly kept it in syrup form. And there are records giving instructions for reconstituting the syrup, depending on the kind of wine that's being used. For instance, Hesiod in the 8th century said that in the summer months, one part wine to three part waters was the correct amount to reconstitute. Hippocrates, that's the guy who made the oath that doctors follow, said that one part Thracian wine to 20 parts water was a good ratio. Now, either he liked his really watery, or the Thracian wine got it really thick when they boiled it down. Also, some regions built places where citizens could get hot or cold or even lukewarm water to mix with their wine depending on the drink they desired. They're called thermopodiums, and there's several that have been found in Pompeii. They actually had public water places where you can go up and take your jug and get hot water from one spigot and cold water from another, or you can get lukewarm water for mixing your drinks. And you thought we had the interesting inventions of coolers. Now, this is back before Pompeii got buried by a volcano. So they did have that ability. They didn't know how to do that. Another way we know they did is there's a system of filtration. There's a gluten or a yeast that's in the juice, and without that gluten, fermentation doesn't take place. You have to filter it out. Plutarch in 46 to 120 AD said wine is rendered feeble in strength when it is frequently filtered. The strength or spirit thus being excluded, the wine neither inflames the brain nor infests the mind and passions, and is much more pleasant to drink. I like this particular quote because he says, hey, if it doesn't give you a buzz, it's a better drink. Because people keep saying, well, you know, like when Jesus turned the water to wine, oh, the good stuff has to give you a buzz. No, the people back there valued the ones that weren't alcoholic. And they mentioned that if you filter it, it takes the strength out. Pliny, in 62 to 132 AD, said the most useful wine was all its force or strength broken by the filter. So they knew about filtering the wine. Now, how well or how good they were at it, I don't know. But they talk about it as if it stops the action of becoming alcoholic. Another way that we know happens, and it was argued for a long time that the ancients couldn't have done it, was refrigeration, until we found popes. See, juice kept at 45 degrees or less cannot ferment. And if the juice is kept cool for a period of time, the gluten will settle to the bottom. And then the juice can be skinned off the top, and it won't ferment, even if it's warmed again. Pliny describes a wine called Aegulis, always sweet is what it means in Greek. They plunge the cask immediately after they are filled from the vat into water until winter has passed away and the wine has acquired the habit of becoming cold. Basically, he's saying it doesn't ferment. They understood this. You put it into a pond, fill up vats, seal it off, put it into a pond, which down at the bottom it gets really cold. It doesn't freeze totally, but it gets cold. You refrigerate it over the winter, and by summer you have juice that won't turn. Marcus Pontius Cato, 234 to 149 BC, says, if you wish to have must all year, put grape juice in an amphora and seal with cork and with pitch. Sink it in a fish pond. After 30 days, take it out. It will be juice, grape juice for the whole year. This was 200 years before, about roughly 150 years before Christ. The Jews, actually, we know how they did it. They would pour a small amount of olive oil on top of juice, placed in caves. The oil produced an airtight seal. The cool caves allowed large quantities of juice to be stored and sold at later times of the year. They weren't stuck to only having drip juice right when they got it off the press. They knew of ways to preserve it. Now, it doesn't mean that that juice tastes as good as fresh grape juice. Their methods of preserving it took some of the taste out or altered the taste, but they knew about this. See, records consistently indicate that the best wines were considered to be the freshest, unfermented juice, even among the Gentiles. It was hard to get the real thing, the freshest stuff. You had to go through some preservation. And it took some of the taste. Boiling grape juice alters the taste. Filtering it alters the taste. Preserving it still alters the taste. And so they valued the fresh stuff. And now what we're going to do, Lord willing, is we're going to continue this and we're going to look at the New Testament side. And I'm going to go through some words that on that side, there's not as many words for wine as there is in Hebrew. Has a lot of words. But in the New Testament, there's fewer words. But there are some terms that we need to look at to understand what is behind what's being said. But we're going to stop there. I know this is not a lesson that's designed to bring people to Christ, but it's hopefully useful to you. We need to understand what we're talking about, you know, and how it's being used. And sometimes we make assumptions, and sometimes those assumptions are not necessarily always right. We'd like to offer, though, an opportunity, not an assumption on our part, but what's taught in the Scriptures, that if you want to be a Christian, there's no other way but through Christ. We have an opportunity tonight, if there's anyone who wishes to become a child of God, or if there's anyone who is a child of God, and like the prayers of the brethren on our behalf, why don't you come forward and stand and sing the song of selection.